Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 22, 2008, the 45th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I'm Harley Schlanger, and I'll be your host today. On our program, we're going to take a look back on the historically significant developments which occurred just last week between November 11th and November 19th. There were three events which took place within that time frame in which Lyndon LaRouche intervened into the current deepening global financial crisis. These were the kind of interventions which may be viewed by future historians as events which saved civilization. Let me just set the scene for you. The election was finally over, and Americans had elected a man they know little about. He's one whose election was facilitated and bankrolled by financial swindlers and traitors, such as George Soros and Felix Rohatyn, who work for interests opposed to the national interests of the United States. And he's one who has thus far demonstrated neither an understanding of the depths of the financial crisis nor given any indication that he knows how to fix it. Then, on November 15th, the incumbent idiot, George W. Bush, hosted a Group of 20 meeting at the White House. As LaRouche stated, less than nothing happened at this conference to even to begin to address the bankruptcy of the world economy. The one sign of sanity in this period was the intervention of economist and statesman LaRouche. On today's program, we'll review what he said at these three events that were sponsored by LaRouche PAC, both about the cause of the systemic crisis, which, shockingly, many so-called economists and experts continue to deny is systemic, and also the solution he is offering, and then the organizing process it's going to take by you, the listeners of this program, to make sure we get out of this mess. I'll be joined today by Executive Intelligence Review's Intelligence Co-Director Michelle Steinberg and two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, Hadi Arafi from Oakland and Will Madursky from the nation's capital. So, Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hi, Harley. Good to be here with this esteemed panel.
Well, we'll see how esteemed it is, but good to have you.
Steamy anyway.
Yes. Now, our regular listeners to this program and those who routinely visit the LaRouche PAC website are familiar, at least to some extent, with LaRouche's forecasts and his analysis of the crisis. But let's begin with a summary of what he's saying for those who are not that familiar with Mr. LaRouche. What does he say we're facing? And let's just start with that.
Okay, well, to the listeners on the LaRouche Show, it's a very somber day, as Harley pointed out. This was the day when the British Empire killed the president, President John F. Kennedy. And that was, until now, the last president that the British Empire had killed, but it was not the first. There was Abraham Lincoln. There was William McKinley. There were others. There was an attempt to assassinate Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And it's appropriate, instead of describing the particulars, to start with what LaRouche has been saying. The subject is dynamics. And 1 week ago, what LaRouche said is, we should be reminded that there are no tragic figures in real world history. There are rather tragic nations and peoples, such as those described by the Homeric Iliad and the tragedies presented by Shakespeare and Friedrich Schiller. A virtual human comedy whose leaders have incurred the misfortune of being what the people of that culture had, like the citizens of our United States, chosen to place in positions of leadership. Real losers, real beasts. And this was 1 week ago, as the heads of state of 20 nations were gathering in Washington for the Group of 20 meeting, which had to be one of the worst disasters in history. But the tragedy is ours. The dynamics of the tragedy is not that you have, as the president of the United States, an idiot, somebody who needed mental help probably as early as age 5 years old. a unrepentant dry drunk, and many other maladies. The tragedy is the dynamics of a civilization, of a culture that elected such a boob and didn't overturn the apple cart when the election was stolen by the Supreme Court. So LaRouche knew that this meeting was going to be a tragedy. It was going to be a mess. And at the insistence of people I would characterize as from the institution of the presidency, who were quite panicked that LaRouche has to weigh in on this financial crisis, and also at the insistence of our friends in places like China, India, Russia, where the major publications and television stations of those three countries have been covering LaRouche regularly. They said, Lyndon, you have to say something to set the agenda before the November 15th meeting, which is supposed to address a new financial architecture.
So that was the impetus for the November 11th private meeting then?
Well, I believe it is, because we had a webcast set for November 18th, where Lynn, knowing that that the November 15th meeting would accomplish absolutely nothing, because George Bush is an idiot, because Henry Paulson and Felix Roatan and George Soros and Alan Greenspan are fascists. He was already planning his webcast, but he received, cries of help from many different circles. Please speak to the issues beforehand. So on November 11th, Lynn gave a presentation which can be found in the November 21st, 2008 EIR called Only My Reforms Can Save the Planet from a Dark Age, which began precisely with reminding people that in July 2007, specifically July 25th, 2007, Lyndon LaRouche gave a webcast in which he opened up and said, nothing can save the current monetary and financial system. We had just begun to get wind of the problems of countrywide bank, the biggest mortgage lender, and Lynn said, that's it. It's going to go. It's gone. And within weeks, he had formulated the initial solution, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, which said, freeze all foreclosures now. If you don't do this, you'll be sorry.
Now, they still haven't done this, have they?
They have not done this, but
they've had every kind of crackpot scheme to supposedly help out homeowners, but it seems as though they all end up putting more money into the banks.
That's right, and you have a bunch of state legislators, city councilmen, mayors, state representatives around the country who are pretty angry. They're pretty hot under the collar about the fact that Congress didn't do that. In fact, Mr. LaRouche got a bunch of emails, one from a sponsor of the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act, and she asked him, why is there so little response from Congress on this? I'm doing everything I can to further this initiative as it benefits the homeowner and the people. What are our opponents saying to stop this bill? It makes perfect sense to me. And what we know the opponents are saying is, we'll kill you if you implement this bill. All right, it's a very ugly answer, a very short answer, a very direct answer, but that's the truth of the matter. When the House of Representatives voted against the bailout on September 29th, they were told by the White House, we will call out the United States Army, the same army that wiped out civilians in Fallujah or whatever. We have a combat brigade right here in the United States under the command of NORTHCOM that might have to be used here in the United States.
And this was just confirmed again by Senator Inhofe over the last couple of days, but this was brought up during the debate by Congressman Brad Sherman from California.
That's right. And then, some people may say that's a conspiracy theory. Well, proceed at your own risk if you think that these financier synarchist bankers who put Hitler in power, who are responsible for mass murder going on in the Congo and so forth, you're living in a dream world if you don't think that you mean it. That so, they mean it.
So, Michelle, this then with this backdrop, with the LaRouche's forecasts going back, especially to July 2007, where he said the system's finished, you had a whole series of bailout efforts made between Barney Frank and Chris Dodd's bill, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the whole list of them right up through October through the presidential election, and yet everything continued to collapse. So LaRouche's message at these meetings was what in terms of the system?
Well, every single one has been a failure, as Lynn said it was going to be a failure. And his message is, and let me go through a couple of these other meetings.
Sure.
Because there was a November 11th, which was one bookend for the Group of 20 meeting. The second meeting was the webcast, November 18th, The Last Chance for Civilization, in which he referenced what he told people was going to happen. He told people at the November 11th meeting, and by people, it was a very select group in two locations, I believe, Washington and New York, that they had to go for the four-power agreement. Now, that is, establish a power block, a force, among nations that are powerful enough to stand up to the monetary system. The monetary system of the British and Dutch empires, most recently run by two Nazis, Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard. They were two Nazis. When Prince Bernhard of the Dutch Empire resigned from the Nazi affiliate in order to marry the princess who would rule the Dutch Empire, he signed his resignation letter, Heil Hitler. But these are the guys who through the British and Dutch East India Company, control globalization and world trade. So Lynn said, we need a power block that is strong enough to come up against the British Empire. This would be the United States with the American system, the only credit system in the planet where governments actually control the utterance of money, in alliance with Russia, China, and India. And other countries would then be happy to join in, all against the British Empire. And this is then Lynn reiterated at the November 18th webcast, The Last Chance for Civilization. And probably we'll come back to that, Harley, because you did moderate that incredible event. Remember, people were calling in, writing in, phoning in, and asking questions from the live audience in Washington, D.C., including members of the transition team, which is important because we have thousands and thousands of people who ask us every single day, what's the Obama administration going to be? And Lynn always has a very alarming answer. First of all, we have to do everything that we can to make sure that he is not assassinated by the British Empire. And his answer to the transition team of Barack Obama was very clear, very ironic. Come talk to me. I have the answers.
Yeah, we had, I think, half a dozen questions between the transition team, and we had some from congressional committees. We had five state legislators, all of whom had introduced the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act, sent in questions about how do we get this implemented, what's holding it up. There were also questions from legislators about the auto sector. It was quite astonishing to see the flow of emails and questions coming in. And it gives you a sense of the thing that the media is trying to deny, which is that Lynn is a factor in everything that's going on, both with the election which just took place and with the shaping of the new administration.
So let me try and answer, and there's no way to reduce this to sound bites. So everything that listeners need to know about what LaRouche's solution is will be in the Executive Intelligence Review and on LaRouche's Political Action Committee website, which is LaRouchePAC.com. But to summarize things, I was really struck by the continuing question, what's the difference between a credit system and a monetary system? So I imagine that that should the new cabinet or the new president or anybody from the current administration, as disastrous as it is or unlikely as it is, come to Lynn, what would he tell them? He says, okay, because of our Constitution, we can create a credit system to replace a monetary system. What you do under this case, with the agreement of the United States and its Constitution, and then with the agreement of the biggest powers, Russia, China, and India, you put all the claims of debt, which are the equivalent of monetary or credit claims, in two piles. One pile we call the manure pile, the garbage. Those are the monetary obligations, the derivative, the hedge fund deals, the all of the speculative futures and options on futures and options and on options and options of futures, and the speculation of shareholder values. That's in the manure pile. The other we call the credit pile, which are really obligations which relate to the physical economy. What is the physical economy? The physical economy is that part of an economic system that relates to the needs and to the expansion and posterity of the human species. Healthcare, education, food, transportation, insulation, all of those things, and most importantly, culture. The human creativity, those obligations are those which are honored. And under the Constitution, under the credit system, which doesn't accommodate to what the private banks want, but tells the private banks, what is your function in furthering the issue of human creativity? Under that issue, all that credit pile of obligations can produce new credit being issued, which is also authorized for monetization. And this credit can be issued as loans for projects domestically or international. So to make a very, very simple point, which many listeners and even our own people might miss, and I know this because I kind of missed it myself, there's not a monetary-ish solution and a jobs solution. If I can again point out what Lynn said very, very precisely at the November 11th meeting. When you go through your credit pile and decide what the government of the United States is actually going to do and wants to do, when you dedicate that new money to projects, you are actually addressing productivity. And in the course of that, you're defining human labor, which means jobs. Now, just to finish up for a minute, because Lyndon LaRouche has no patience for what Hank Paulson, Greenspan, Bernanke, and Chris Dodd, Nancy Pelosi, and Barney Frank have done. No patience at all. Those guys belong in jail. But what the Paulson plan did, remember, he wanted $700 billion with no debt ceiling, and wanted to write in the legislation that this bill cannot be repealed and this bill cannot be challenged in court. I mean, talk about a Mad Hatter's tea party with Adolf Hitler playing the Mad Hatter. I mean, that's basically what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And what this plan did was reduce the United States, in my opinion, the sacred mission of the United States as a temple of liberty, to a pass-through for the swindlers.
With the swindlers operating over and above any regulatory functions of any government.
Well, they were telling the United States Treasury, listen, no one's going to lend us money. Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, J.P. Morgan. There is no bank in the world, there's no sovereign wealth fund that's going to lend us enough money. So what we want you to do is you give us the money.
Mm-hmm.
But then the question is, where was the United States going to get the money? We have a deficit of $500 billion. We don't have enough revenues in the next you know, in the next year and a half to pay for that amount of money. We don't have the revenues for that. So we have to borrow. That's what I mean by a pass-through. In other words, they're saying, we have an idea. Paulson and his gang of synarchist cronies, we have an idea. You, the United States government, you be a pass-through, and there you'll guarantee our loans, which we couldn't possibly pay. So it's, you know, it's unbelievable. It's true. It's such a swindle. And what Lyndon LaRouche said yesterday, Harley, as the derivatives reverse leverage bubble, the hedge fund mess began to unravel. He said the bankers have moved from fear to panic. And the way we're looking at it, first there was denial, then there was fear, and then there's panic, and the next stop is LaRouche. There is no other solution.
Well, if it's not LaRouche, it will go from fear to panic to chaos and destruction.
Right.
You've been listening to Michelle Steinberg discussing the three events of this last week in which Lyndon LaRouche addressed three different audiences. The first one was a private audience both in Washington and New York on November 11th. The text of his opening remarks are available for you to study on the LaRouche PAC website. Secondly, the full 2 hour and 45 minute webcast from November 18th is available on the as a video on the website. That's the webcast from November 18th. And then November 19th, he spoke to a meeting of diplomats. I had the privilege of attending that. There were leading representatives of about 20 nations there from all continents, engaging in a very sober and frank dialogue with Mr. LaRouche about what are we going to do to deal with this crisis. Now, Michelle is going to be with us. She has some more to say, and she'll be involved in the roundtable discussion in the second half of the program. But I'd like to bring in our LaRouche Youth Movement panelists, because the one of the challenges that Mr. LaRouche has thrown out to his supporters everywhere is this question of leading the fight for his solution. And he said it's not a question of a laundry list, it's not a question of a series of simple steps, but it's actually a conception, having an idea of what the American system is. And Will Modersky, who is with LaRouche in Washington, D.C., is with us. And Will was telling me before the program of some of the work that they've been doing to develop the capacity to explain to Americans the difference between a credit system and a monetary system. Because, you know, most Americans, they think credit system, well, that's credit cards, that's loans, what's wrong with that? But they don't, they actually can't tell the difference between a credit system and a monetary system. They lump it all together under consumption. So, Will, welcome to the program. What can you tell us about the work you guys have been doing in Washington to develop the capability to communicate this to our poor fellow Americans?
Thank you, Harley. Thanks for having me. What I'd say is that what's most interesting in this circumstance, D.C. as an example or as kind of a specific example, is what's currently ruling or guiding the state of mind of the majority of the population on a day-to-day basis, as it is, you know, with all hell breaking loose in terms of financial, economic, jobs, the real economy in terms of the auto industry. What's happening on a day-to-day basis and what's actually guiding most of the population's concept of the world around them is exactly what Mr. LaRouche has been saying for quite a number of years, decades even, is not actual economics, which is, you know, the marketplace, right? Shareholder value. You got tons of people losing hundreds, thousands, billions of dollars in some cases, such as people who should be losing that money, like George Soros, but they're actually being guided by things like watching the market. Today it goes up, tomorrow it goes down, the next day it goes up again, the next day it goes down. Or maybe their 401k, maybe their retirement plan generally, or maybe they have a little bit more of a connection, or are hit a little bit harder, and they lose their job, or they lose their home, or, you know, gas prices are up and down, heating oil is up and down. These type of things are typically what's guiding people, you know, their day-to-day interaction with the world around them, or at least so they think. And so the question is, things are getting worse and worse. Well, I guess two things. How are people awoken from that delusion of seeing the market, seeing such financial derivatives of the physical economy as the world around them? One, how are they woken from that state of mind? And two, how do we actually intervene with the proper conception of real physical economics as Mr. LaRouche has defined and developed it through the last 40 or 50 years? And so to the second part first, because what we've done in D.C. is pick up a number of initiatives around a study of economics, you know, in the policy or practical sense of credit versus monetary, a distinction that Mr. LaRouche has made very, very, very clear as being the defining characteristic of an empire or an imperial system, today known as globalization, versus an American system or a constitutional system as our country was defined and originally birthed by Hamilton specifically, and a few people later on, such as Matthew and Henry Carey under Lincoln's guidance or under Lincoln's administration. So what you have is this idea of generating credit. And Michelle brought this up to some degree and developed it. In a simple sense, it's a question of how you invest and where you put your money. Because it's not like currency is a bad thing. It's not like that you don't need circulation of credit and that type of thing. It's a question really of how you use it, of what you're actually investing in. And the concept that has to be driven by, and this comes to the first part of how you wake people out of this, the concept that must drive a nation's investment is the concept that Mr. LaRouche has of physical economics, of specifically the role of human creativity in the productive process, in the actual increase of productivity of a nation or a population's labor force.
Now, Will, let me just stop you there to throw something out to you, because many people who have been watching Greenspan as though he actually is the guru of the economy know that what Greenspan keeps saying is that productivity is producing money. You know, he changed the terms from physical product to basically saying you divide the GDP by the number of hours worked to determine productivity. So it was a purely monetary consideration. Now, what you're saying is that productivity is based on creativity. Now, first, I'd just like to ask you, from all the experience you've had in dealing with economics students on campuses, people on the Hill, Capitol Hill, staffers and others, how widespread is the delusion that Greenspan had, which is that it's all money?
Oh, everybody. Maybe in my 5 years organizing on the streets, I've talked to maybe four or five people who've had a concept above a monetarist outlook.
So this is really that when Michelle talked earlier about a tragedy, this is a key component of that tragedy, that people literally believe in fairy tales about the economy.
Exactly. What's guiding their state of mind, what's guiding their daily, you know, their day-to-day actions and existence, really, from their standpoint or their state of mind, is this mystical view of money and of how money makes things happen. A good example that was actually used by another organizer was the fact that people get mad at the gas station when gas prices go up. Or, you know, people think that because grocery store's prices get more expensive, there's something wrong with the grocery store. And there's a complete disconnect from any physical productivity. But to counter that idea, it doesn't just work to kind of say, well, we need manufacturing and that type of thing. What really kind of shakes people out of that delusion is what Mr. LaRouche has been very clear on, which is we're headed towards a dark age. We're headed towards an existential crisis of civilization, and viewed from the standpoint that it takes a certain amount of productivity to actually support the human population in a physical, you know, biological sense. You've got to have food, you've got to have water, you've got to have shelter and various other things. As a more developed civilization, we have things like health care and sanitation and these types of things. We currently have a population of 6.7, 6.8 billion human individuals on this planet right now. Our current productivity in terms of the ability for one human being to produce what it takes to support his and other human beings' existence, our productivity is actually dropped below that level of being able to support 6.7 or 8 billion human beings. So what you're seeing is these crises in water management and food production and management generally, as well as things like transportation, electricity, these types of things, healthcare. The crisis that's erupting is an expression of this is an expression of a lack of understanding of Mr. LaRouche's concept of physical economics, of how you actually must revolutionize the way that you support your population in terms of industrial output, of production of things like steel or copper or other types of metals that go into the building of various facilities for, you know, maybe an electricity grid, maybe a hospital, school. Yeah.
One of the points that Mr. LaRouche has been making repeatedly is that since the late 60s, early 70s, each year we've had a decrease, that is a drop per capita and per kilometer squared in the amount of production that's going on in the United States economy.
Mm-hmm.
So that this gets to really the heart of the matter. It didn't just sneak up on us that a few people lost their homes and all of a sudden there's a foreclosure crisis and the banking system's collapsing.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good example of how really thick the delusion is within the population, that policies have shifted so dramatically and so clearly obvious to someone with an understanding of Mr. LaRouche's idea of physical economics over the last 40 years, from administration to administration, including, you know, such as the Clinton administration, which was certainly one of the better we've had since JFK specifically. And I think the way that we've been intervening on that and making that very clear of both the distinction of a credit versus monetary system, but also clear of this shift that took place, is the videos that the LaRouche Youth Movement have been producing and posting on the LaRouche Political Action website, LaRouchePAC.com, specifically on this the series we just began is called The American System, An Introduction to National Banking.
Oh, yeah, there's a really good one that's just posted now with Chris Yadits looking like he's about to jump through the camera. Grab the listener by the throat and say, "Looky here, buddy, you got to listen to me."
Exactly.
But what he says in this is really quite, it's absolutely essential for people to look at it and listen to it and think about it. Will, I'm going to come back to you in a moment, but sure. I want to bring in Hadia, who's also organizing. She's out on the West Coast, and you know, people sometimes say that Obama is going to move things from Stanford to Berkeley, you know, Stanford being the lair of George Shultz and the right wing, and Berkeley, of course, associated with the so-called more liberal economic policy. But, Hadia, when you go to Berkeley, you find the same delusions, don't you?
Yeah, Harley, I do.
What are we doing there? How are we getting across to people?
Well, one thing that we're doing is we're actually giving them a chance. We're setting ourselves out there. But we're getting a sense of what people in Berkeley are thinking with the students, because it's completely different at UC Berkeley versus, you know, San Francisco State, which is not too far away, where the students there are rallying about the budget cuts. And you can easily stop students because they know what's going on. School might not be able to afford them. They won't know what to do. But at Berkeley, it's the moral question is more, it's necessary. It's like you pose the situation to students, and for them, it's a moral question of whether they're gonna act.
Well, you brought up this question of budget cuts. I mean, to what extent are people that you talk to in California aware of the fact that California has one of the largest budget deficits in the world right now? It's now at $30 billion for the next 18 months, and that's after $15 billion in cuts. Are people aware that the state is coming apart, that they're raising tuition, cutting loans, cutting health care? Is this something that's generally known?
At San Francisco State, it is. We went to the community college where a lot of people don't pay tuition. They just get their fees waived. We were asking, and there doesn't seem to be any type of stir about any change happening within the next year.
So they don't believe that the Messiah is going to come in, Obama is going to come in and wave a magic wand and everything's going to be all right? Or do they believe that? Maybe they do.
To a certain extent, some people mention Obama and they ask, you don't think that Obama is going to, deal with these issues? And then it becomes clear, well, what exactly are you doing that's going to be different, from what you were doing when Bush was in power for the last 8 years? And are you going to change?
So you still see, when you talk about the moral question, you still see people in an illusion, a state of illusion about the economy.
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting is at Berkeley you have really liberal ideologies. They don't have any sense of how civilization has progressed to where it is right now. And so they put out these ideas of, well, people should suffer, maybe they'll learn to change to change that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michelle, from the meetings that you've been attending with Mr. LaRouche as well as your organizing, I think in the nation's capital we are seeing a difference. People are beginning to get a sense of the profundity of the crisis, are they not?
Yes and no. Yes, because they're frustrated. They're like, in a way, like babies when they can't, reach something. And they're frustrated because after pouring hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars into loan guarantees and so forth, nothing has improved. The foreclosures haven't stopped. The rate of joblessness is beginning to frighten people. I know everybody who's listening knows this, but that figure of 542,000 people applying for unemployment, those were full-time employees. These were people with full-time jobs 1 week ago or 10 days ago. They all flooded to the unemployment websites or offices all at once. And had to get unemployment insurance. That means in less than 3 weeks, we have over 1 million full-time employees unemployed. So this is scaring people. And one of the things that happened at the webcast on November 18th was someone from Washington wanted to know what Lynn's view, I think this was another transition team question, what is the viability of the American auto industry?
Right.
And Lyndon LaRouche said, the American auto industry as an auto industry has no viability whatsoever. It's a waste of money. It's a failure. It's a deliberate failure. It's a case of suicide. It committed suicide. They didn't do the things they should have done, and we lost it.
And what does he say should be done with the auto sector?
What should be done is to look at the river system of the United States, look at the need for the improvement of the locks and dams along the Mississippi, Missouri, and the Ohio. These could be repaired, rebuilt. If people think that this navigable river system just was there by grace of God, again, they're living in a dream world. It takes engineering. It takes, forming out of metal these vast structures that actually steer these things. You have a desert growing desert, a spreading desert in northern Mexico and southern parts of the United States, we need what's called the Plino system, and which is a water management system to make the desert bloom. So what Lynn's saying is give them projects, and I'm quoting this here, give them projects. They don't need an auto project. The people need employment. Give them back their towns, save their towns and cities, give them back their employment. They don't have to produce automobiles. They can produce something. So stop saying building back the automobile industry, that's a swindle, it's a fake, we need the infrastructure.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, the Congress was discussing this week. They put it off for, I guess, till December 2nd. They told the auto industry to come back with a more viable option. Clearly, at best, they're stalling. But the idea, what do you think? Do you think the American people would be happy with the idea of another $25 to $50 billion going in to bail out the auto companies?
No, Harley, what I'm doing in the meetings with, Lyndon LaRouche couldn't possibly do all the meetings that people want to do with him. That's why we have people like Hadia and Will and myself and you to other degrees and so forth meeting with the people who have the questions. What I'm telling them is repeal the darn bailout.
Yeah.
Repeal it. Right? It's not that we, like Will was saying, it's not that we're against credit or against money. We need to put money in the economy, but it has to be attached to real productivity and real creativity. And I just want to say one other thing, because this is the other thing that is so hard to get across, which I think probably Will and Hadia can address further. We're in a dark age. This is not a depression. This is not a great depression or a greater depression or the greatest depression. This is a dark age. And one of the things we're having in EIR this week is the introduction to Boccaccio's Decameron.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Giovanni Boccaccio lived in Florence. He was born in 1313. That's 1313, folks. 1313, the 14th century. He died in 1375 in the middle of his life. Was the biggest banking collapse of the Lombard system, which was set up by the evil Venice. And that collapse, coupled with the collapse of civilization and the onset of a disease, the bubonic plague, one third to one half of every single living human being in Europe died. That's a dark age. So the two issues that Lynn is addressing to the real revolutionaries of the youth movement and of patriots of every nation, of every republic, I should say, because some nations are not republics. They need to be changed. But ours, we do have that system, is creativity and the new dark age. So I think we have to give leaders and the population a sense of that dark age, because as when Lynn referenced Boccaccio actually wrote about what happened in his city of Florence, the once prosperous city of Florence, where people were dying on the streets and the corpses were left to rot, sort of like is going on in Africa right now in the Great Lakes region. And so he said that it became a point where the no one paid any more attention to the death of a man than they did to a goat. It was more like, get that smelly carcass away from me before I catch a disease, than the idea that a human life had been lost. So we can go to a dark age in barbarism, and we have to inspire people to really be human. And I'd like to ask the Heidi and Will if they have any comments on how we're dealing with that.
How about it? Will?
Yeah. On that note, or on kind of the where myself and Harley left off, is with these videos and Chris Yaditz's video is an example of actually gripping the audience in a dramatic way, presenting material, and we're working on this right now. We're in the process of revolutionizing a lot of the material on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website, LaRouchePAC.com, with a number of, how could you say, playful interventions. Specifically one dealing with Alice in Wonderland, where as Boccaccio demonstrated the insanity of his culture, of his population, of the people around him, with these you know, stories from kind of sitting around the fire of a, you know, of talking about how crazy, just relating all these crazy stories. What we're doing is using the example of Alice in Wonderland, of, you know, the Wonderland of Wall Street, basically the Wonderland of the people currently running this country and the world into a new dark age, and to really just ridicule them, causing them to lose any semblance of respect or dignity within the eyes of the population, and kind of, you know, snap people out of the dream they've been in, a nightmare more than anything, that has been allowing them to be fooled for the last 40 years to think that, you know, so long as they have their credit card and, you know, their Corvette to sleep in, they don't need a house because they just got foreclosed on, or they don't need a job because they just lost it.
Well, Will, let me give you a concrete example. We have a question sent in from one of the listeners, Amos, what to do with my money? He said, I've been very lucky in as much as I took all my money out of the stock market before the collapse. And for those who did that, well, at least you're not losing it in the stock market. However, he says, now I'm wondering what I should do with it. Should I reinvest it back in the next year? Should I buy foreclosures and start a business? Should I continue to hold it and live on the interest? Now, clearly, Amos, the fact that you took it out of the stock market showed that you had an inkling of what was going to happen. But the rest of your question shows that you're caught up in the hopes that somehow there's a personal solution that's going to provide you some kind of comfort zone. And as Michelle and Will were just talking about, and Boccaccio is a perfect example of this, where was the comfort zone in Florence? Where is the comfort zone when the whole civilization is declining, collapsing, disintegrating, and human beings are turning against each other as though it's the law of the jungle, survival of the fittest, which is in fact what the logical conclusion is of this free trade system that's breaking down. So, you know, Amos, there are a couple things I'd recommend to you, one of which would be send money to us. We'll put it to use buying the equipment we need to get more videos, to make sure that our videos go viral on the web, to make sure that we get more material out to people. That's one of the best ways you can secure your future. The other thing, just for those people who think you can put your money somewhere where it's safe, one of the questions for Mr. LaRouche on the webcast was about what's going to happen with the hyperinflation that he'd been forecasting, that we've seen a deflation recently. Prices are falling. The price of oil is down to a third of what it was just a couple months ago. The dollar is strengthening. So people are ignoring the fact that when you pump trillions of dollars of money to cover already bad debt, you're building up a potential for hyperinflation, so you could put your money somewhere where you think it's safe. I mean, suppose you buy a couple of $100,000 certificates of deposit and you think you're clever because they're insured, but suppose the hyperinflation devalues each dollar so that $100,000 is now worth $100. That's what happened in Russia. That's what happened even worse than that in Weimar Germany. When I say Russia, that's what happened when the Soviet Union collapsed. It's happened before in countries, and this is what a dark age means.
And, you know, if I can just add into that, what in the world are you going to do with a foreclosed house? There's three on my block. If he wants to come buy them, they'll be as empty after he owns them as when the bank owns them. No, on a quarter of a mile in Leesburg, which is the highest income, median income, Loudoun County, Virginia, the highest median income in the entire United States, because they're sucking off the trough of the George Bush, Dick Cheney, Halliburton bubble. A lot of people, you know, live here and had jobs and thought they had jobs, are losing their contracts now. So on a 1/4 mile, there's five homes that have been vacant for over a year. And there's been four or five contracts that for people to buy them The one house was $390,000 bought by the last owner in June 2007, and the last person who made a bid and got the bid at $190,000, that's $200,000 wiped out of its value for the bank who owned it, couldn't even get a mortgage for that.
And that means every other house on the block, including yours, Michelle, goes down in value.
Well, thank God, because, you know, they tax you on that, on that inflated value, well, too. During the Great Depression,
sure,
a lot of farms were lost, not sure, because they were mortgaged, but because they couldn't pay the tax on the land.
And the reason to bring this up is not to mock our listener who wrote in, but to make the point that even good people have not gotten this message. They haven't figured out what it means when LaRouche says it's not a cyclical crisis, it's not a recession, it's not a depression, it's a total global breakdown into a dark age. When you lose the instruments of self-government, when you have the Congress as corrupt as this Pelosi-led Congress, the only thing you have is a population that can mobilize itself, and the hope that there are some people in the institution of the presidency that are above party, above politics, who will take action. And that's what Lyndon LaRouche is addressing. How do you move those people around the president to cause the president to move in a direction that will save the country? And a key component of that is mobilizing the population. And so our listeners have a responsibility to study these three documents from LaRouche, including the Brutish Empire piece, which was really written to prepare for these three events, and to get out the discussion, get people on the website, get them to listen to this show, which will be archived. And I'd like to ask Hadia if you have something else you want to bring up with Michelle or some other ideas. Also, Will, we've got about 8.5 minutes to go in the program. Hadia, you have anything more?
Yeah, just one quick comment. That's exactly the problem to look at with the students at Berkeley, is this idea that they have so much power to change the institution of presidency or influence the institution of presidency. But instead, you know, they might right now just be thinking, how can they make it inside of the current system that's collapsing? And so they have all these weird ideas about survival. But if you can make up for the lack of education they've gotten and how America came to be. And it seems like that's what we're going to have to take up with the students at Berkeley.
Well, I think it's not just Berkeley. I think it's everywhere. I think it's universal. Will, did you have something else to add?
No, I think it's summed up.
All right, but you guys are going to continue with this project. Are you preparing to take Henry Carey and Alexander Hamilton and into the Congress and into the new institutions of the incoming administration and educate these guys?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that work building up over the last couple of months was from that standpoint, and we have done much of that. I think more and more, though, as the crisis hits, a lot of that stuff is being almost self-evident in terms of policy outlook, in terms of a so-called capital budget, which Mr. LaRouche was calling for years ago, is becoming a word used to essentially distinguish the current bankrupt budget system that they're using. When they realize they have to invest in infrastructure, the only option they have is LaRouche's concept of a capital budget, and on top of that, a much more developed sense, a credit system. So more and more, it's kind of by default that Mr. LaRouche's ideas are being brought up or brought into in these discussions. What we've been demanding of a lot of these congressional offices is just shut up and bring LaRouche in. You got some stupid hearing on derivatives happening. You're going to have George Soros come and talk about it. You know, dump him and bring LaRouche in.
That actually happened this last week, didn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And on top of that, briefly to end it, what's more and more necessary is actually a concept of creativity, actually conveying to these people in the Congress and wherever they might be that what's on top, what's universal, is the idea of human creativity, is that outlook on why you have a credit system, why you have a constitutional presidency designed the way Hamilton and Benjamin Franklin designed it.
And that issue of creativity is also the central theme of LaRouche's latest paper on Mathematics is Not Science. Michelle, we have just about 5 minutes to go, and I'd like to come back to the four-power agreement. There's an APEC summit underway where the idiot-in-chief is down there, Bush, doing his swan song. But there's clearly diplomacy all over the world, people grappling with this question of what do you do about the collapse of the dollar system, of the international financial system. And LaRouche has emphasized the Russia-U.S. relationship. What's the latest you can give us on the kind of discussion around that?
Okay, first of all, can I tell our listeners that if you don't have a subscription to EIR online at this point, you are really in danger of losing the lifeline to the solution to this crisis. And people can call in 1-800-278-3135. 1-800-278-3135. That's a toll-free number about how to subscribe to EIR.
Yes, you can tell them that.
Oh, can I say it again? Oh, okay. The latest on Russia is very, very exciting. Rachel Douglas, our Russia editor, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago, I believe, is translating the Lyndon's article on the Brutish Empire. And one of the most exciting meetings that that I know about was a university meeting that was held in Moscow by a longtime LaRouche collaborator. And, you know, to me, listeners, you might not know this, I am I'm a baby boomer, and I lived most of my adult life in a period of time where there was an artificial enemy relationship between the United States and Russia. Many of you probably remember it. The Cold War, air raids when we were 5 years old, air raid sirens would go off and you'd have to go hide in the hallway or under your desk or hit the floor, whatever, you know, several times a week because the fear of nuclear war was there. And in fact, Russia as a country was our greatest ally. It was Russia who helped the American Revolution with Catherine the Great's League of Armed Neutrality. It was Russia under Alexander II that sent the Russian Navy to warn the British, don't you dare intervene to break up the Union and backed up Abraham Lincoln. It was Russia who were our allies to defeat the Nazis. So why were we at war with them? Because that's what the financier oligarchy wanted. So at this meeting in Russia, this university professor had a seminar. There were 60 to 70 people there. And one of the centerpieces of this presentation was he assigned one of his students for her paper. You know, she wanted to do something on the economy to prepare a presentation comparing Paulson's plan to LaRouche's plan. And I understand there was a whole PowerPoint and so forth. So it was a fantastic, exciting meeting. Now, down there in Lima, Peru, our EIR correspondent, Sarah Madueño de Vasquez, stood up and asked the question. So if George Bush and company or Gord and Brown thought they were going to escape from LaRouche, no way. She stood up and said, to China's finance minister, do you, Mr. Minister, believe that China would be prepared to propose to the United States, Russia, and India, as American economist Lyndon LaRouche is proposing, that you jointly convoke the rest of the world to discuss the urgency of imposing a new world financial architecture, a new Bretton Woods, inspired by that established with Franklin Roosevelt? By now, there's not at least doubt that the conclusions reached by the G20 meeting, as LaRouche says, avoided the seriousness of the problem and instead worsened it. Would China be willing to do so to take this first step toward turning the direction of history? And the minister kind of punted. He never expected such a question, I'm sure. He said this was a very interesting one, but did not address it further.
But needless to say, since we're down to about 30 seconds, this is on the table everywhere.
It's on the table everywhere, and there's only one solution, the new Bretton Woods.
The new Bretton Woods and an alliance of four powers, India, Russia, China, and the United States. But it has to be LaRouche's new Bretton Woods because, as they say, accept no substitutes because the substitutes are designed to sabotage it. So, Michelle, Will, and Hadia, thank you for joining us today. This has been another edition of The LaRouche Show. We'll be back on, as always, every Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll see you next week.